Imagine a world in which post-traumatic stress no longer robs from millions who suffer.
You don't want to get help because you're embarrassed. You don't want to tell people the dark stuff that you've went through.
That stigmatism of you can't talk to people is so true.
Post-traumatic stress is not a disorder. It's an injury that can be healed quickly so that those who suffer get back to thriving in their families, communities, and mission.
And I said, I don't want to live this trauma again. Yeah. And he goes, you don't have to.
Yeah.
And I said, what?
The experts, they forgot to tell me I can heal. I didn't know that I can get rid of PTSD.
Each week, we tell a skeptical world what is possible with stories of those who have successfully cured their trauma.
I just remember being able to stand by the water and look up at the sky and hear the noises, and I didn't think they were gunshots. I was like, those are Disney fireworks.
I don't even know what to imagine for myself now, my future, because I have one.
This is Life After PTSD. Well, I want to welcome everybody to another episode of Life After PTSD. At the conclusion of 2019, we did a highlights reel, some of our favorite cuts from that year's episodes. And there were lots of great stories this year and tons of guests that were so gracious to give of their time and share of their stories, holding space for those who are out there still suffering. And I want to thank all of those guests and contributors who shared their stories and made 2020 a great year of hope and healing. But on today's episode, we're going to go in a different direction. Rather than do a year in review format, we've decided to go sort of have a living room conversation with someone that I think is a legend for the work he has done in his field. Dr. Frank Ochberg is a founding board member of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies and recipient of their highest honor, the Lifetime Achievement Award. He edited the very first text on the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and served on the committee that essentially defined PTSD. He was an associate director for the National Institute of Mental Health and director of the Michigan Mental Health Department. He developed with colleagues the National Center for Critical Incident Analysis, the Global Youth Connection, which is a human rights organization, Gift from Within, which is a charity for persons with PTSD, and the Committee for Community Awareness and Protection. He's the first physician to receive the Law Enforcement Medal of the Sons of the American Revolution. And he retired from Michigan State University as clinical professor of psychiatry. And ironically, it was after all of this, when he was retired, that I found him. So while searching for others in our space that share our belief that PTSD is not a disorder or an illness, but rather an injury, it's something, by the way, that we believe is being vindicated by the evidence, both anecdotal and research, by some of the great modalities that are being developed out there that are really showing efficacy in clearing trauma. But it was also something that America's finest had told us for the longest time, that PTSD is not a disorder. It's an injury. We found an article dated September 19th, 2012, titled "An Injury, Not a Disorder." Subtitle: "Post-traumatic stress disorder has been an accepted diagnosis since 1980. It's time for clinicians to adopt a new name: post-traumatic stress injury. That is more accurate, hopeful, and honorable." Of course, my interest was piqued when I read this, and I want to read a few portions of this article written by today's guest, Dr. Frank Ochberg. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, has been an accepted diagnosis since 1980, and that's a good thing. So why is it now making controversial headlines? Why are some clinicians like myself, along with a wide range of veterans, advocates, women's groups, and others, arguing for changing the name of the diagnosis, PTSD, to PTSI? For post-traumatic stress injury. In large part, this argument has been inspired by retired General Peter Chiarelli, and I may be saying that wrong, so forgive me, the former vice chief of the staff of the U.S. Army. After two tours in Iraq, the general grew alarmed by rising suicide rates in the Army. He reviewed every case and came to the conclusion that many servicemen and women hate the term disorder and suffer in silence rather than endure that label. For a soldier who sees that kinds of things soldiers see and experience on the battlefield today, to tell them what they're experiencing is a disorder does a tremendous disservice, he has said. It's not a disorder, it's an injury. Jonathan Shea, MD and PhD, whose pioneering studies of veterans earned him a MacArthur Fellowship, and I agree with General Chiarelli, we wrote to the American Psychiatric Association President John Oldham, MD, on April 7, 2012, proposing that the new edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, currently under review, adopt the PTSI name. We wrote that there is a crisis of suicide, stigma, and misunderstanding affecting young veterans. Anything that helps them seek help is worth consideration. We then argued that the name affects civilian survivors of trauma as well, crime victims, women who are raped and battered, and others who develop the syndrome. Finally, we explained how the injury model applies to the history, theory, and treatment of this condition. Many endorsers are men and women who have received a PTSD diagnosis who are grateful for the help they have received, but who ask the APA on their behalf to rename the condition an injury. They tell us that they will feel less stigmatized, but they also explain how the concept of an injury rather than a disorder does justice to their experience. Once they were whole, then they were shattered. When their counselors, employers, friends, and loved ones behaved as though they were survivors of injuries with lingering wounds, they could heal. When they felt like mental patients and were treated as persons with pre-existing weakness, they could not heal. Indeed, if the APA changes its name to PTSI, all of us must make it clear that we are doing this because our patients and potential patients and their advocates have convinced us this is accurate and honorable and hopeful. But we are not suggesting that the consequences of traumatic stress are any less significant, painful, and capable of creating disability. In fact, we believe a name change will help protect benefits by securing broader public awareness and support for those who suffer from the signature psychological injury of war, violence, and human cruelty. In sum, PTSI is a better term than PTSD. It is accurate. It does justice to the condition. It is preferred by those who contend with the condition. The APA would bring credit to itself and respect to its patients by adopting this improvement in diagnostic terminology. So there it is. And after finding this article that dated from 8 years ago, I said, I've got to meet this guy. I've got to talk to this guy. And I just started searching. And so as the internet goes, was able to find some contact information and Dr. Ochberg responded. I'm so excited that today we get to sort of, again, have a living room conversation with a guy that is such a wonderful advocate in this space. He's a wonderful man. It took such an interest in us. And as we bring you right into this interview, literally the first thing he wanted to hear was from my co-host Carrie Russo and I and how we got into this space. So without further ado, here's kind of our words with Frank, and enjoy. The lion's share of what we do is telling stories of both clients and clinicians, you know, just anybody in our network that's gone through some kind of evidence-based modality for the treatment of PTSD to the point where they would now say, I don't suffer from PTSD relative to that particular trauma anymore. So we tell their stories, but we also have, a lot of the researchers behind that come on the show, like, you know, Dr. Richard Gray, who's done an incredible amount of research for the RTM protocol. And, you know, we've had him on before just to talk about the brain and what we know about the brain. And I'm salivating to kind of talk with you and just for you to share, you know, why, you know, as a guy with your scientific background, why is it that, you know, I've got this guy here that's such a strong advocate, probably the leading one online when I go search for, you know, for names and positions, why is it that this guy is advocating for, you know, PTSD or PTSI, you know, versus the D and everything? I think the listeners need to know that because every once in a while we do run into, you know, people that hear the intro of our show, which unapologetically states that we believe that post-traumatic stress is an injury, not an illness, and it's an injury that can heal. So, you know, for us, you're an ally, for starters.
Oh, yes, and you're a huge ally for me. And,
yeah.
And, you know, you guys are young guys, and I can't believe that I've turned 80 years old. I always was a young guy. What happened?
You're still future, young.
I hear you, man. You sound younger than I do. So
actually,
awesome.
I just tell you, you know, we have a friend. We have a friend who is 98. Who has done some, so he's actually, he was a veteran. He's done some therapy with us.
World War II veteran, mind you.
World War II veteran. He's been on the show. His wife died just over a year ago, and he is getting married to a 90-year-old. Is that not great? So you're young. Like he wishes he was only 80, right?
He called me up the other day and I told him, I said, I don't think you're ready for this. You need to mature a little bit. You need to grow up a little bit. And you know, you know, the bad jokes we tell, right? So
that is wonderful. Hey, yeah. Listen, but before we get into it, can you, each of you, tell me just a little bit about yourself?
Sure, sure.
You certainly have shared it with a large audience.
Yeah.
But I want to know what got you enthusiastic and doing this.
All right. So I'll start. So Carrie is the director of First Orlando Counseling Center. And, you know, we've known each other, 10 years, I guess? My training, my background was actually pastoral. And I'd done that for about 10 years prior to coming here. And then I came here and I was here for about 5 or 6 years before I started to really get in the marriage space and really saw a need to, you know, not be so much in the spotlight of standing behind a pulpit or standing up and making announcements and doing all that kind of stuff. Like I really wanted to burrow myself in a cave working, you know, with couples and really doing intensive work. Cause I felt like by and large, that was not happening, you know? So I'm starting to work with couples and I was getting really good at it. at least I thought anyways. And when I say good, I meant good at really having like rapport with them early on. And
I mean, marriage is being saved and things
like that. Right. But there was a blessing and a curse in that. I mean, that obviously was the blessing part, but the curse came when the better I was getting at doing that work, you know, the more quickly I was able to identify these sort of invisible barriers or invisible sort of monsters that seem to be at present with these particular couples. And I'm talking about couples that were like in it to win it. Like they really were committed to the processes that we were doing. And just for whatever reason, they weren't winning. We'd have a good couple of weeks or months or something like that. And then a major regression, a war would start, you know, for no apparent reason. And I remember just reaching out to Carrie. I said it was about 4 or 5 years ago. I feel it was more than that. Maybe it was like 6, 7. Anyway, so I reached out to her and, you know, she kind of was helping me identify that these are probably traumas. And I don't, you may not remember this, Carrie, and I'm sure my memory is probably a little bit fuzzy on it as well. But I feel like one of the first conversations I had with you was, okay, well, do you have any tools and what can we do for it? Carrie has the nerve to tell me, well, when I got into therapy, I swore off trauma, basically is what she told me. And I'm like, Carrie, I need some good news here. Where is this coming from? Yeah. And fortunately, there was a second half of that story, and I'll let you kind of take it from there, and then I'll jump back in.
Yeah, well, the story is, so I've been a therapist since I went straight from college to my master's. So I was, and I did college in 2.5 years. So I was really young. I was like 21 years old, getting my master's, thought I knew all that. Right. And after, when I got out of school, the first 17 out of 20 cases had to do with some pretty significant trauma in teenagers I was dealing with. And I remember thinking, I can't help them. I don't know what's going on. What they tell me in school isn't working, you know, to just get them to tell about how they were raped and just talk about it and feel comfortable, tell it over and over. And I'm like, this doesn't work. And I made a decision. I'm not doing trauma. I will do this. And my boss at the time, his name is Dr. Bell, and said, I went to him and I was like, I can't do this. And he said, well, how about this? And he gave me this whole assessment. You know, you can do assessment. You're young anyway. It would be good if you just did assessment. So I got really good at assessment. The problem with assessment, you know, so if kids with ADHD, learning disabilities, gifted, all of those things, even personality disorders for court. So I got really good. The problem is I started seeing kids where I was like, they don't fit into these assessments or this adult, and realizing, oh my goodness, it was trauma. So early on I said, I'm not doing these traumas anymore. This is too horrible. Can't deal with this. And then realizing, oh my goodness, I cannot get away from this. I mean, I did for a while by doing like learning disability testing, but then realizing that I was misdiagnosing kids with learning disability or ADHD because they really had just been traumatized. And I thought, I can't keep doing this. So anyway, I was an intern here years ago. I'm now the director. That was 27 years ago, yes, 26 years ago I was an intern here. And went out, did my own thing, came back. It's been close to 10 years now that somebody came to me and they're like, hey, you need to get this trauma training. This is the thing. And so it was accelerated resolution therapy is what it was. And since then, which was interesting, I watched your video on counting therapy. And
what did you think of it?
I was so intrigued because it's similar. I didn't do the whole training yet. I just watched like the little demo, but I was like, it's so interesting. Because a lot of what I feel like what you're doing is memory consolidation, right? You're giving them time, like you're opening up that, you know, in my little bit of videos, I watched what I could find. So I watched quite a few of them, but you know, they were short, but my understanding, and correct me, but it seems like, okay, you're going to open up that window, but you're giving them a safe space and there's an end to when they have to think about it, which is interesting because it is kind of what we do as well. You know, you're kind of like, I don't know, but it was interesting. I was like, wow, I'm so intrigued that he was doing this so long ago. I mean, because how many years ago did you start doing that?
Boy, thanks for asking. And I don't have it in front of me, but I can remember. I don't want to publicize the name of the person, but it was with Maya. She was a school teacher and she had been raped several times by a sadist, a guy who was very close to being a serial killer. And he got into her life and he scared her by saying that he could have her children taken away from her.
Oh my gosh.
If she reported him, he had an official position. Well, she was a fantastic person. And we sort of invented it together. I wanted to find a way of helping somebody relive this inescapable memory that they had after they had come to trust me. And I figured I'll count out loud to 100. I'm not trying to hypnotize them. It's really, in a way, the opposite, because they can't help moving back into their own trauma when they don't want to. It happens in a nightmare. It happens when they're just triggered. Something else puts it in their mind. They don't like to have this happen, and they feel it's controlling them rather than them controlling it. So I developed it with a patient, and bless her, she's as much to thank as I am. And this was one of the first ways that I'm a medical doctor, that a licensed medical doctor could help somebody share their trauma memory. And let me just say a little bit about it. So I let them know when I think they're ready for this, that I'll count out loud to 100. And while I'm counting, they'll allow themselves to have the memory that they've already described to me. So in one case, it's a memory of being raped, and it's in another case, it's a member of a young soldier going with night vision goggles into a pillbox where there are Iraqi soldiers, and he kills them, and he walks out. That haunted him. I count out loud to 100. I tell him that when I'm counting in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you make sure you get to the worst of it. And when I'm counting up in the 90s, you make sure you're back here. And I can tell when I'm doing it. They're not talking. They're gazing off at the other end of the room. I can tell when they're really in it. Sometimes you see a tear. Sometimes you see a facial gesture. But then they're out of it. I've gotten to 100. And then the instruction is, tell me what you just went through. And I write it down. They see me writing as they're talking. I usually don't interrupt them. I get it all down. And then I say, okay, here's what you just told me. And I read it back. And I might say something while I'm reading it back, like, and that's when I think I saw a tear come down your cheek. And then it's over. Then we talk a little bit about it. What I think I've helped them do is move the memory from one mode in the brain to another. It goes from being this trauma memory that drives itself to being an autobiographical memory. And they feel a certain amount of mastery, maybe not immediately. And if next week when I'm seeing them again, they want to do it again, I will. But recently, it's often been just once. Now, people have tinkered with it, and they found their own ways to do this particular element of exposure therapy. A colleague of mine goes into it in great depth, this prolonged exposure. I'd rather not do that.
We agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think what we share is wanting to help someone get through this without a lot of mumbo jumbo and whatever works for them. Also, eye movement desensitization. I was trained in that. I do that. I raised some money so that we could train psychiatrists at Yale to know these three different methods and use them with different people. And then we did outcome studies on it. And it turned out that the counting method was as good as anything else, but it was the easiest one. Hmm. So the people who were trained in all three preferred it.
Was it counting EMDR and something else and prolonged exposure?
Yeah, prolonged exposure.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
See, but now, as you both know, there are lots of things that get at this. This isn't all of PTSI. because BTSI also includes becoming kind of cynical and down on yourself and down on life and down on others. It includes being numb and not having a lot of positive feeling. I'd love to talk with you about my color wheel of positive emotion, but let me hold off on that for a while. Yeah. And then the stigma that comes with it. PTSI also includes having your alarms go off and having an alarm system that prepares you for deadly danger is vital. We need that. What we don't need is to have false alarms or to have a condition in which we are so aroused, whether we know it or not, that we're having physical disorder and we can get hostile with other people. We don't concentrate well, we don't sleep well, and we're not very good at being intimate. So all of that wrapped up is what my colleagues decided. We met like a congressional committee. We decided this would be PTSD. Now some of us are saying, come on, let's call it an injury. We can see how the brain has changed. And if you're injured, you have honor. You get a purple heart when you're in combat and you get shot. I've had many patients who've been shot, and they also have PTSD, and they'd much rather deal with their physical wound than with the wound to the way that their mind is working. But every audience that I talk to would prefer us to change the name to PTSI, except the American Psychiatric Association.
Well, and Frank, I want to talk to you about that for a second, because it's interesting, as I've read, you know, even people that were largely supportive of your work. By the way, there's a lot of people that are extremely supportive of it, but, you know, say some of the dissenters out there online who have kind of been in the topic or whatever, you know, one of their arguments is, well, you know, if we change the name, it's really not going to change, you know, much or whatever. It really doesn't make a difference. But I just heard a guy in you tell me that, you know, you and your colleagues said, we've seen how the brain changes, right? So, yeah. So your claim on this is not just that it's, you know, we're trying to bring honor. That's a big part of it. And we certainly want to validate that point, but you guys have seen something you can't unsee. And that's a change in the brain that literally has led you to that belief, correct?
Yes. Yes. And also the way the science is progressing, Jeff and Carrie, we're zeroing in on more elegant studies of the way the brain is different. And we didn't have that evidence early on. And look, I'm not the world's expert on the minutiae of the brain change.
Sure.
I sum it up, and I think you've seen, I have podcasts, webcasts, and stuff on just to make it, to oversimplify it. But let me oversimplify it right now.
Sure.
The amygdala, there is an almond-shaped structure in the midbrain and both the right and left brain, and it has a lot to do with sending out total body signals all over the body that prepare us for fighting or for fleeing. So if your amygdala, let's call it hot, it is overactive. It's been changed. The opposite would be if your adrenal gland is no longer putting out the adrenaline that it needs, or if the adrenal gland has a tumor in it and it's putting out too much adrenaline. That's real. That's an injury.
Sure.
That happens classically with post-traumatic stress injury, a hot amygdala. There's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, and it's near the amygdala, and it has its own shape, and it tends to be smaller. It could be smaller going in, or it could be smaller after you've had this particular injury. It gets anatomically reduced. And that seems to be a part of the brain that automatically gives us a sense of where we are and what's going on. It's like a gyroscope that gives us a feel for reality all around us. well, listen, if your reality sensor is down and your hot button is high, you're in your trauma. You're not in the right space. Mm. And then the frontal part of the brain, all over the frontal part of the brain, it has connections that come back to this inner part, the midbrain. And that's where a lot of our social instincts and reflexes are, all over the white matter and the gray matter of the frontal part of the brain in a coordinated way. If you have a tumor up there, a small tumor or an injury up there, sometimes you're acting in a very socially inappropriate way. When I was an intern on neurosurgery, had a ship's captain who was meticulous, and he goes out of the house in the morning with his fly open. Now, had he been a drunk derelict, that wouldn't mean anything. But this guy would never do that. And turns out, brain tumor. Well, the frontal part of your brain is somehow offline with classic PTSI. There's more to it than that as well. But if your brain has been injured into that kind of a pattern, that overlaps a lot with the condition. And what a lot of people forget is the saddest part of this condition. In a very caring person, let's say a deeply religious, spiritual person who believes in right and wrong and who loves his family, the last thing he wants is to be there at his daughter's christening, which matters a lot to him. And he thinks he's bringing a black cloud in that is ruining the meaning of all of this for everyone else that he cares about. That's this syndrome as well. And I feel so privileged to have been part of putting it together and part of helping people who have it. And let me tell you, talking to you guys now, this is what it's all about. It's for my generation to pass this on to your generation and for you to pass it on to others who come after you, and to say, let's stop making it worse for people who have been victimized and traumatized. And the worst of it is when they've had encounters with evil and they can feel diminished by having survived evil. Well, they shouldn't. That's what I find myself handling a lot now. And I think it's where your field, you come from a counseling field. I come from science and medicine. Why can't we put it all together and be rational and humane and inspired? Because when we're doing it, I think we are fighting for people's health, for people's understanding, and we are doing something collectively to turn encounters with evil into having the will to do good with other people.
All right, well, I think that's a great place to take a break. Let's hit pause there and let the listeners kind of catch up and catch their breath. We'll come back even stronger. You are listening to Life After PTSD.
Hey, Life After PTSD listeners. We're glad that you love other stories of healing, but what about you? First Orlando Counseling is the premier trauma therapy center in Central Florida with a full staff of trained clinicians ready to help you clear your trauma without re-traumatization. Childhood abuse, relationship abuse, a traumatic car accident, birth trauma, first responder or military trauma, even phobias. You don't have to live like this. It's time for you to heal. Schedule a consultation today by visiting firstorlandocounseling.com or call 407-514-4470. It's that easy.
Here we are back with Dr. Frank Ochberg on Life After PTSD. It's such an honor to talk to him because you're talking about literally a pioneer, a founding father of this field, sort of served on the committee that defined PTSD, was the editor of the first text on the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and is now advocating and has advocated for a number of years now a definition change to PTSI based on what we know now about the brain. Frank, you talked about coming from the medical or say the physical field. You know, Carrie obviously works in the mental health, emotional, we'll just label that the emotional space or whatever. But, you know, let's interject that third dimension here, and that's, you know, you're again talking to a guy whose training was from a spiritual field, right?
Spiritual
help. And I'll tell you, you know, to sort of to finish the story from earlier concerning how we got into this, in reaching out to Carrie, you know, it was an acknowledgement that, look, I'm dealing with people here that we've walked them through processes of forgiveness and things like that, that spiritual care would often provide. And yet they're still carrying the memory, right? They still have the images of an event that they just simply cannot, you know, they cannot shake. And so oftentimes in the spiritual realm, you know, in the spiritual world, we'll say things like, well, you know, we almost imply like that's your lot in life to carry, you know, this, God forbid this rape happened, this sexual assault happened or something like that. But now you have to, you have to forgive for starters, which is just welcome, wonderful news for the average person to hear. I'm sure you can imagine, and not just that, you have to forgive and you have to sort of bear the scars, you know, of that image. And the person's over here going, first of all, the hardest thing that I'm ever going to have to do is forgive. They'll acknowledge that. But even if they can, you know, then they live sort of tortured by that memory. And you can, as you know, when you bring that life experience, you know, that sort of uncleared trauma that still affects a person into, you know, a marriage, a work relationship, a friendship or whatever, it's bound to rear its ugly head. And I felt when Carrie and I first connected on this and I was able to start sending people to her or to some of her staff, I mean, it literally was like a tag team effort. And it was like, you know, I am not the right resource for the job right now. Right. If we're going to do effective marriage work, I need them to be with you and your care. I need this invisible barrier or whatever removed. Send them back to me. We'll resume the process. And that's effectively how we've worked, though I've gotten trained now in some trauma work with neurolinguistic programming and some other things, you know, to be able to do some of that stuff on my own. And I still feel a lot of times there is often a great resistance. You know, we often say, well, the emotional and the physical aren't, the doctors and the psychologists aren't talking. Well, the doctors, psychologists and the pastors aren't talking either. You know, and that conversation needs to happen because to me, it's all connected. And this idea has often been perpetuated, I think, in the church that there's your spiritual life as this sort of like this perfect one third of your persona and who you are. And I go, look, if you believe what you really believe, then all things are spiritual, will include your body and your mind. And we don't chastise somebody who is a church going person for going to the doctor to get healing for their broken leg. Why would we do that when it's their broken heart or their broken emotion or whatever? So to me, bringing all of these dimensions to the conversation together, we all have a part to play. And I think as we're starting to see that, you know, it's not like this is the first conversation that's ever had in this realm. The three of us talking on this call here, there are others that are doing this as well. And I think the more of us that are doing that, the more we're actually seeing, you know, people really getting a new normal of their deciding and not being stuck with the one that was decided for them by a trauma or whatever.
Absolutely. I'm grinning from ear to ear. We're on the phone. If we were looking at each other, we'd see big smiles. I've been invited to work with clergy and pastors in the military. Currently, I'm working with journalists, and I want to put a pitch in for them because journalism ends up being conflated and confused with people who are not doing real journalism. The real journalist goes after truth on our behalf, and they dig in and they write about or they portray things that are real, and it's dangerous. And I think I've helped. I've been a transitional person helping to bring journalists into the Society for Traumatic Stress Studies and to recognize what they do for us. So I'm not talking about somebody who has a strong opinion and beats a drum over and over again. I'm talking about somebody who risks her life to get up close and personal in a war zone and talk about the impact on the people who are there. So, and I feel privileged that they now have there's Ockberg Fellows are named after this connection of trauma science to journalism. And we're now saying that trauma science should be connected to the spiritual leaders who understand mm-hmm. the impact of trauma. Mm-hmm. I wrote a little thing called the Survivor Psalm that ends up with, I was a victim, I am a survivor.
So I have worked with reporters who do reporting on all kinds of things, right? And so they hear these stories. So not even just the ones that go into the war zones and report, you know, and risk their lives, but even the ones that are on a daily basis looking at the pandemic, right? And doing a story on the pandemic, you know, and doing a story on the person that, you know, freak accident or you know, all of those things. And they start thinking about all these things and they become traumatized. And so it's interesting.
Carrie, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, Carrie, in the last revision of PTSD and on the books, I wasn't part of that team, but the team changed the definition of a trauma to include people who, through the nature of their work, are exposed. We didn't have that in there before.
Right,
you had to encounter it directly yourself. It had to happen to you or to somebody that was really close to you. And we didn't want it to just apply to people who see a lot of television and then say that they're traumatized. But if your work means that you have to do it, you can pick it up. It's sometimes called secondary traumatic stress mm-hmm. or vicarious traumatization.
And what I wonder is as we go, well, actually, let me revisit the spiritual piece too. You know, the spiritual, someone we just had on the podcast or we were just recording with today talked about mm-hmm. being raised in a Catholic home. And after he got his first, you know, kill and he was a combatant, it was absolutely mm-hmm. It was somebody who should have not been here, but he felt that guilt, you know, like, oh my goodness, I shouldn't be doing this. And so that spirit, just even that being raised, and I said, that's a normal reaction, right? You did something. So I think, and I wonder now that we have, you know, so much, not just television, but we have so much social media where kids mm-hmm. and adults all are watching things live, like things mm-hmm. are happening live. It's not just a TV show that somebody filmed. Like mm-hmm. they're watching other people's lives even, right? I wonder if our trauma is going to extend to that. Like those people being diagnosed with trauma, like in the next revision, it may include those because when you are watching that over and over and exposing yourself to that, and then you start fantasizing about what could happen to you or what, I mean, it just, there's just so much right now happening in our society. And years ago, we didn't know when, you know, your brother's best friend from high school's sister's daughter got some rare cancer that your friend had. You know, like there's so much intricate knowledge that we have now of things that are happening. And so because there's so much of that, we hear so much more that could happen to us. You know, I think the pandemic has been interesting where we've been watching. You know, years ago, it would have just been the news, right? Reporting how many cases here and there, you wouldn't have seen all the stories on social media that are sharing. I mean, I just had this morning, somebody I knew, he passed away. He's 50 years old, 4 kids mm-hmm. from healthy, and he was healthy. And so I think people start seeing so many things because you mentioned about we don't want that to be just people watching TV and say they're traumatized, which I agree with you. But I think people are experiencing other people's lives, you know, and I don't know. Could that be trauma too at some point on some level?
Yeah, well, Carrie, yes. And there are a lot of people who are traumatized deeply. As a member of the team that helped write some of the official definitions along the way, you know, over these 40 years, I can tell you that it doesn't mean that we are specially gifted and we know exactly what to call this or that, but it means we reach an understanding that we're going to call this amount of trauma and this amount of let's call it mental health symptoms that are connected to the trauma, we're going to call that PTSI or PTSD. Then we're going to be able to do studies on people who have this label. They meet the precise definition, and we can find out what kind of remedies work for which kind of people. It gives us a universe that we can study. Now, even if you don't qualify for the precise definition, you can be really troubled. You're losing sleep. You're getting sick. You're turning to remedies that aren't good for you, like alcohol, and overdoing it. And a doctor or a wise clergy person who is comfortable at hearing what's going on and who has some tools of the trade can help. I guess what I'm saying is we are all in this together. If we're thoughtful people and we listen carefully and we apply approaches that are documented to be useful, they're worth doing. When you're a licensed professional, you really have to use interventions that are appropriate for the license that you have. You're not supposed to just go and invent things on your own and do them. It has to be, quote, evidence-based. But there are a lot of things that we do and do very well that aren't part of the evidence. They're part of our personality, our character, our ability to understand others, and to help somebody bring out the best in themselves. I find what I believe I end up doing is getting a sense of what is really valuable and useful within this person, and try to help them understand what their strengths are, and how to make more of their own gifts. That's a little different from saying, well, here's something that someone else does, or here's something that I do that works for me.
Absolutely. Now, I have a question for you. Yes. Because you are in the age of psychiatrists who probably, I'm thinking, went into psychiatry thinking they're not just going to do medication like the psychiatrists of today, because back then mental health counselors weren't really, and psychologists were doing assessment. I'm just curious. Is that the case? I mean, when you started doing psychiatry.
That is absolutely true. Thank you. Yes. I will not take on a case if it's only to give drugs. Yeah. I'm not interested in doing that.
Yeah. And that's
And I hope that'll come back.
Absolutely. I think it should. I think that psychiatrists should be paid the right wage so that they can do what they were initially intended to do. Right?
Yeah.
Because I think that's been a problem. But
Frank, let me ask you one more question if you could. And I think this is a good place to wrap up today. You, you wrote the original, really the first text on the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, I edited it.
Sorry.
But,
yeah.
But some of the famous names now, like Bessel van der Kolk and Judith Herman and others, they wrote the chapters in their areas of expertise way, way back in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So my question for you is, knowing what you know now, how would you write it today?
I would leave it up to the younger generation to write it today. And they already are writing it today. Mm. It would be a blend of what is kind of technical, but there are these people who are very good at science are also very good at writing for public understanding. So it would have up-to-date concepts in what is going on and why it's going on and what are the various remedies that work. The danger, I think, Jeff and Carrie, is that someone will come up with something exciting and new, and it can have thousands of people who are impressed. But it isn't necessarily going to work for everybody. Mm. And it might not work for every part of what we're calling PTSI. Mm. So the let's say the eye movement or the counting method, that might help you handle one part of the consequences of being so badly traumatized. But it doesn't necessarily help you recover your feeling of being loved or of your capacity for having the emotion of love. And I tell that story somewhere. We're going to have to talk again. And I'm going to want to talk with you guys.
Because I want to hear about the positive wheel, too. So we'll do that next time.
I tell you what, have a look at it, because it's on the web. It's in several different ways. Webcast, podcast, and just an essay about it. And let's see if we can get into that and other things as well. But this was all about PTSI. Yes. And I think it's high time we change the name to post-traumatic stress injury, or we had both names. There are a couple of things where you can use one label or another. Hmm. Why not use either label and let the person who has the label choose which one they want?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're not changing the criteria. And people are afraid that if we call it an injury, it won't have the same amount of benefits. They're afraid they're going to lose money. Well, that doesn't have to happen.
Definitely I
think we're getting the right idea that it is an injury, and we're adding honor and we're taking away stigma. Mm.
Well, Frank, I want to say thank you for the work that you're doing. I mean, we started this show really 2 years ago, I guess it was. Now we're coming up on the date. And, just to tell stories and just to hear from people like you that are, for us to advocate in the field. I'm thinking of a show we just recently did with a Green Beret where, hearing his story and hearing stories like his, and it's not just military that's obviously dealing with trauma and PTS, but we hear these stories and we go, man, the least that we can do here on the ground to support, our heroes and those who have walked through situations that, God forbid, the rest of us should ever have to walk through is to advocate for them, right? To surround them with good, with good science, tell their story and connect them, I just feel like we have a responsibility. It's a responsibility of helping our fellow man heal. And you've been in this space for a whole lot longer than we have. And so it's an honor to talk to you, and I look forward to future conversations for sure. Let me ask you real quick, is there a way that people can, how would you recommend if somebody wanted to learn more about your work or maybe connect with you in some kind of meaningful way?
I always say, just look it up. I am phasing out my business.
Sure.
I have a medical license. I'm not going to renew the medical license after this 3-year period.
Okay.
So I don't want to increase my own work and business, whatever you want to call it, but let me tell you, passing it on to your generation, having women in leadership positions, that's very important, because this field has been dominated by men, and paying attention to the social issues of our time. There are people who, by nature of race or prejudice or caste system in certain areas, they have so much more to handle and to deal with. So caring about our fellow man and woman. Isn't that what's driving each of you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Without question.
Thank you so much for sharing today.
To learn more about our work, visit lifeafterptsd.org and find further reading and resources to help you on your journey and opportunities to partner with this mission. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star review and share it with your community. For production inquiries or to sponsor the show, email info@lifeafterptsd.org.